This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
I'm coming to a difficult realization. We suffer through early signs of climate shift. Things like super hurricanes, storm surges, fires, and very strange weather. But the first and biggest hits of global warming are hidden from us, at the poles and in the ocean. Earth could experience catastrophic loss from climate change before humans realize it. You are about to hear breaking science, pointing to hidden warning signs of extreme climate change. While we fret and sometimes die from heat waves on land, unreported marine heat waves are striking more often and more violently in the seas. Scientist Eric Oliver explains. Then Mark Eakins, the coordinator of NOAA's Coral Reef Watch, reports the latest science. Up to half the Great Barrier Reef of Australia has died in the longest marine heat wave ever seen. Most of the extra heat we generate with greenhouse gas emissions goes into the ocean. Hidden beneath the waves, that is where the climate action is. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. For years, we have been told that most of the extra heat from our greenhouse gases goes into the sea. But what is happening there? I've written to experts around the world trying to get the big picture of marine warming. Crickets. Well, finally, we have a new paper published in the journal Nature, and it warns us about marine heat waves. The lead author is Eric J. Oliver. He earned his PhD in physical oceanography from Dalhousie University in Canada's maritime province of Nova Scotia. Eric has also been a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Tasmania. Many of his co-authors are Australian, with more authors from the UK, particularly Scotland and the United States. From Halifax, Canada, Eric Oliver, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Well, as you know, on land, a heat wave is pretty relative. People in the UK think they're cooking at 28 C or 82 Fahrenheit. That's just another day in Pakistan. So how do you define a marine heat wave?
Well, you make a really good point that what is or isn't a heat wave, what isn't extreme, is relative to what's normal in a particular region. So that is exactly what has informed the basis of our definition of marine heat wave. So we have a qualitative way of defining what is a marine heat wave. That is to say, it's a prolonged period of time where water temperatures are anomalously warm relative to what is expected at that time of year. And then we can further quantify that, which is what we did in this study, to say that a marine heat wave is triggered when water temperatures are higher than the 90th percentile for a particular time of year, and that persists for at least 5 days. And what the 90th percentile means is that it's a temperature that you would expect 9 days out of 10 to be less than. So 1 day out of 10 is that hot or hotter. And so if that temperature is exceeded for 5 whole days in a row, at least, then we've entered a marine heat wave state. And because that percentile calculation is dependent on the actual variability of temperature, that scales by region. So in somewhere like the tropics, where there's not a lot of variability of temperature, the percentile allows us to trigger a heat wave when it's only maybe 1 or 2 degrees warmer than typical summer temperatures, because that is quite extreme in the tropics. Whereas here, say off the east coast of Canada, the water temperatures are really variable. That might not be triggered until it's 3, 4, 5 degrees warmer than average.
And what got you looking into this, and why has this information been so hard to find?
In 2011, there was a marine heat wave that occurred off the west coast of Australia. And while these kind of extreme temperature events in the ocean have happened before, and certainly to a large degree are evident in the natural world, this one gained a lot of attention because it was so extreme. It was the coastal temperature loggers measured 5 degrees warmer than average in the middle of summer. And offshore measurements recorded by satellites said 6 to 7 degrees warmer than typical summer temperatures. And this event persisted for an entire month. So it was oceanographically and climatically really interesting and anomalous, but also there were impacts on ecosystems. So there were fish that were found out of range. There were fishery closures because of temperature sensitivity and things like abalone. And there were, the most interesting to me is the kelp forest ecosystem collapsed under the temperature stress, and there was a rise in the seagrass ecosystems in its place. And in fact, that change from kelp to seagrass has persisted since the event in 2011. So this event that came along caused an impact, and then the event went away, but the impact remained. That kind of ability to, the ability of a transient event to permanently affect the system really shocked people, and it was quite interesting, let's say, from a scientific perspective. So a researcher based at the University of Western Australia, Professor Thomas Warnberg, brought together a few people to lead this working group on marine heat waves. So himself, Dan Smale, who's based in the UK, Marine Biological Association, myself and Professor Neil Holbrook. Neil is still, and I was at the University of Tasmania at the time, the four of us led this workshop that was held in Perth, Western Australia, in 2015. And we brought together a total of 15 researchers from around the world, from all those countries you mentioned at the beginning. And we cut across three main fields of expertise. We had climate scientists with a lot of experience in extremes. We had physical oceanographers, and we had the marine ecologists. And we got together for 3 days, and it's often hard to speak the same language when you've got a physical person and a biological person trying to talk about the same thing. We often, even the same words can mean different things, but if you're in the same room trying to have this conversation over a few days, you get there, and that's what we were able to do. And the outcome of this workshop was that we ended up with three lines of research that we would then scatter back around the world and pursue. And one of them was actually, how do you define a heat wave, which is how we came up with that definition that was published in 2016. And one of the other lines of research was, what can we say about the global record of marine heat waves? What's the global distribution like, and are there any long-term trends happening? The expectation being that there might be, given the kind of long-term warming we've been seeing in the ocean and the atmosphere for the last, well, decades to centuries.
Well, before we get into the specifics of the paper, I have to say, like, if fish run short due to marine heat waves, that can start minor battles between countries. It can threaten protein sources for millions of people. So this is a very important topic, and I'm surprised there haven't been more studies on this before.
Well, that's a really good point. And I think, I mean, there are a couple points to make about that. One is that there have been studies on marine heat waves. If you look up marine heat wave on Google Scholar, say, if you just type in the keywords, there's been essentially an exponential increase in that term being used. In the past, certainly people would have talked about sea surface temperature extremes or temperature anomalies, things like that. Certainly El Nino, that happens in the tropical eastern Pacific, you could characterize that as a marine heat wave. It's a period of time, quite prolonged, where water temperatures are very high. In 2003, there was an event in the Mediterranean, and that was published. They didn't use the term marine heat wave, but it fits very much into our framework. So people have been looking at these. But I would say that the difference between what happens in the ocean and what happens on land or in the atmosphere over land is that it's so much harder to see what goes on in the ocean. So when we have a heat wave on land, the most obvious impact is that humans feel stressed, we get hot, we don't want to do very much, we're sweaty. But we also see that, well, our animals get stressed out. In Australia, for example, they have flying foxes, which is like a large kind of bat, that once air temperatures reach 42 degrees, they just fall out of the trees that they hang on while they sleep. So the impacts are much more obvious in the atmosphere, whereas in the ocean, if you're a fisherman or if you're an ecologist who's out there interacting with the ocean regularly, then you can see that things are changing, although maybe you don't actually know that the water temperatures change unless you're measuring it. And the rest of us just kind of notice, oh, the beach is warmer today. So I would say that these events in the ocean are more hidden. So it's easier for them to go by unnoticed.
It recently hit the news that a swordfish was seen off the coast of British Columbia, and we also have seen more of the big tropical sunfish. So some surprising things are happening out there. We also had the blob, that this big pool of hot water that hung off the North Pacific, off the coast of Washington State and British Columbia for quite some time. Is that part of what you're studying?
Exactly. That is another example of a marine heat wave. That is a pretty interesting one because it was so persistent. A lot of these events that blink on and off around the world tend to be on the scale of maybe a few weeks to a few months, whereas that event persisted for something like two or more than 2 years. But it does nonetheless fit into our framework of what we think of as a marine heat wave, a prolonged period of anomalously high ocean temperatures. And it had the same kind of impacts. There were range extensions of different kinds of fish. There were fishery closures, marine mammal strandings, I believe, toxic algal bloom outbreaks. That one was interesting, though, because it actually fed back on the atmosphere, right, and affected weather patterns over western North America.
It did, and I lived through it. Now, in your study, you talk about comparing periods starting around 1925 and moving up towards the present. How can we possibly know what the sea surface temperatures were in the 1920s or 30s?
Well, ships have been out measuring them, basically. But the longer answer to that question is that getting the right data sources and pulling the data together in the right way was a big part of that study, and I'd say one of the big successes of the study. So to define a marine heat wave, we really need daily measurements, fairly high-frequency measurements of temperature. And we were interested in doing this globally, so we needed this information globally. And that kind of information really has only been available since the early 1980s, since satellites have been recording surface ocean temperatures daily. However, we were able to supplement that data with two other sources of data. So one would be daily measurements, not global, but at a few sites around the world where they have recorded temperatures for a very long time, 100 years and more in some cases. Places like the lighthouses in BC, for example. There's a few stations along the west coast of the U.S. and some in Europe. These are just examples where over 100 years ago, someone decided we need to start recording temperatures, and they would go out to the shore with a bucket, literally, and measure it, or measure it off the end of the pier. And that has persisted until now. So we have these truly invaluable records of ocean temperatures, in situ coastal ocean temperatures. But that's not global. A third data set that we have that is global are analyses and amalgamations of data that would be recorded from ships that have been going around the oceans for hundreds of years, really. Ships have always been recording ocean temperatures. And these are more infrequent, and there are products that take these data and grid them and provide them in regular packages. And that can effectively give us global monthly measurements of temperature. So we have these three data sources: satellites, a few stations, and these ship-based records that can each have their own strength, whether it's daily, global, or long-term. And we're able to effectively borrow the strengths of each data set together to construct this record of marine heat waves going back to 1900.
So in the period from 1925 to 2016, did the frequency of heat waves increase?
It did. So our results show that there was a statistically significant increase in the frequency of marine heat waves. And we define frequency to mean the number of events that happen on average per year as a global average. So it's very average, but we're taking a global picture. And the data is showing us that in the early part of the 20th century, there were a little over two events that would happen per year. Whereas in the latter part of the record, so basically the last 30 years or so, that's increased to, in very recent years, up to four events per year, but on average, something like three events per year. I think that's a 34% increase, if I remember the number from the paper correctly.
And what about the duration? What did you find there? How long they last?
Similarly, so we defined this average duration, which is to say you have so many events occurring per year. How long are they on average? Some events can be quite a bit longer, some are shorter, but on average in the early 20th century, they were about 10 days long. Whereas in the last 30 years, they've lengthened out to up to 14 days long.
So we're getting more of them, and they're lasting longer. This sounds serious.
Correct, yeah. And while thinking about frequency and duration, it can be a bit confusing maybe to think about that in a simple way. So an easier way is actually just to think of, well, how many days per year are part of a marine heat wave, or how many marine heat wave days are there per year? How many days are ecosystems going to be exposed to extreme temperatures? So if you have a certain number of events per year and they have a certain duration, then you have a certain number of days that are part of those heat waves. And that number has increased by 50% over the time period that we examined. So it's something like 30-ish days on average per year in the early 20th century, and that's increased up to around 40-45.
Now, we have natural cycles that you do talk about in the paper, like La Nina and El Nino and those sort of things. I'd like to leave those aside for a minute and zero in on what is the background sea surface warming trend, which, according to the paper, is 0.16 degrees C per decade. If that's true, one would think that over the past 100 years, the sea surface would have warmed by about 1.6 degrees C, and that is actually greater than what is reported for land warming.
Well, we do know, actually, that the ocean is a huge reservoir for a lot of the warming that's happening around the globe. So it's unfortunate that the impacts are so hidden and our attentions are diverted away from the ocean, because a lot of change that's happening in recent decades is happening in the ocean.
And it must take a massive amount of energy to increase the sea surface temperature at all.
Yes, I imagine it would do, yes.
And it's going to release that slowly, that heat. The whole ocean is going to release that heat again very slowly over centuries or longer. I've also encountered, along talking with various scientists, that there will become a point where the ocean ceases to become such an effective heat sink for our greenhouse gases. It should slow down their absorption rate, and then we get whatever we put into the atmosphere will come back on us much quicker. But I guess that's outside the boundaries of this study, is it?
Yeah, that's a longer timescale thing, but it's something that we need to be cognizant of when we're thinking about this. So what's going on there is that when we think about the oceans warming, we're often thinking about, well, it's the surface ocean that's warming. And there are certain areas around the globe where that surface water is convected down to the deeper parts of the ocean. So the North Atlantic is one area, or all around the Southern Ocean is another area. And this process is a fundamental part of the global climate system. You can think of it crudely as a conveyor belt. Maybe you've heard the global conveyor belt terminology in the past. So this is, for example, in the Atlantic, you have warm water brought north near the surface. In the higher latitudes, it cools and is made more dense and drops to the deep. And the time scale for which that water stays in the deep before it comes back up to the ocean surface is something like 1,000 or thousands of years. So now we're at the beginning of that process where the earlier tracks of that global conveyor belt, let's say, have this warmer water that's newly warmed because we've been warming the climate system over the last one and a half centuries. But as we continue to warm it and as it continues to pull it down, it's going to fill up that conveyor belt with the warm water. And once it's filled up, then it won't have that capacity to keep to store it away anymore effectively.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. With me is Canadian ocean scientist Dr. Eric Oliver. We are discussing his new paper, Longer and More Frequent Marine Heat Waves Over the Past Century. Eric, let's talk about what is happening in different parts of the world. Why don't we start with the region where you live, the Maritime Provinces of Canada, and of course, New England. What does your study show there?
Well, we didn't focus very much on the regional impacts, actually, in our study. We were trying to elucidate what's the global average trend, really, to make more bulk statements. But you can look at what the changes are regionally. And certainly on the long time scale of 100, 115 years, effectively, almost the entire ocean is experiencing these positive trends in the marine heat wave properties that we looked at. There's really only a few places where we don't see increases in the marine heat wave properties, and that really maps onto regions where we don't see strong increases in ocean temperatures. The biggest, the most conspicuous region being the far North Atlantic, and this has been noted before. There's what they've called a global warming hole in the high latitudes in the North Atlantic, where it actually appears to be cooling or not warming at all, certainly on a 100-year time scale or so. And the consensus, as I understand it, that's emerging now is that this is being related to a slowdown in the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation, which is one of the limbs of this conveyor belt I was talking about. It's that part of the North Atlantic that brings warm water or brings surface water down to the deep.
I didn't see any discussion in the paper of the actual Arctic Ocean. Is that why?
No, and that's because we excluded regions that had ice cover for longer than 5 days, which is most areas that have any kind of regular occurrence of ice. And that was mainly for statistical reasons, because we didn't want, because of the definition of a heat wave having to last for at least 5 days, it would have interfered with our ability to calculate heat waves. But that being said, it's obviously very important to look in those regions, in the Arctic and around the Southern Ocean as well. And now that I'm based back here in Canada and interested in these higher latitudes, I think it's something that I will be looking into pretty soon.
Yeah, we just had news of an ocean heat wave in the Tasman Sea between Australia and New Zealand, and I know you were working in Australia. What are marine scientists saying there, and how much is this part of the great threat to the Great Barrier Reef?
So what happens in the Tasman Sea and around southeastern Australia, I would say, is decoupled from what happens in the Great Barrier Reef in the sense of the specific drivers of those events, not talking about global climate change. What happens around Tasmania is really, really interesting because Tasmania is a cool water ecosystem generally. So we have a lot of cool water species that have refuge there because much of the waters around Australia are much warmer. But unlike, say, here in North America, where if waters tend to warm, the cold water species might just migrate further north, in Tasmania, in Australia, you don't have any higher latitudes, actually. So Tasmania is as cold as you get, and then you've got 3,000 kilometers of Southern Ocean before you find Antarctica. So when things happen there, when the waters are warming there, it can have really detrimental impacts. And they're losing things like their giant kelp forests, and a lot of their fisheries and aquaculture systems are under stress.
And when it comes to the long-term viability of at-risk ecosystems like coral or the food fisheries, or as you mentioned, why do you think heat waves matter even more than the gradual increase of mean sea surface temperature?
Well, I'd say they both matter. The key is that when an impact happens, generally, that's not because the mean has warmed. That's because an extreme has occurred, an extreme event has occurred, that extreme event sitting on top of the mean, which may have warmed, but the extreme event has occurred that's pushed something over some kind of a threshold. So really, it's the extremes that we feel. In the summertime, maybe, let's just say for the sake of argument, that this summer is 1 degree warmer than a typical summer 30 or 40 years ago. You're not really going to feel the difference between 25 and 24, say. But that extra degree can push the frequency of the more extreme events, those heat waves that are up in the 30s, that extra 1 degree can push the frequency of those extremes up in a way that you do feel them. And that's the same thing for marine heat waves. So the mean is important, but we feel the extremes, I guess, is the way to phrase that.
And just the idea of marine heat waves stimulates so many new fields of research. I think we could look, for example, at the effect on algae blooms. I've talked to experts on plankton, and they say, well, we don't really know how this is going to go, whether it will increase or decrease with global warming. And then we have the whole idea of marine heat interacting with storms. We know a hotter ocean can drive bigger hurricanes. There's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, I think this is exactly the list that you put there, and I could add more. It opens up a very broad range of topics to study, and the thing I find exciting about it is that it opens up these topics that have cross-disciplinary aspects. So you listed a few that would mean physical and climate scientists working alongside ecologists or fishery scientists or working alongside hurricane researchers and forecasters and things like that, and that's one of the things I find it very exciting about it, that it has this sort of cross-disciplinary impact.
I realize science really reports on the past, but what are your thoughts, Eric, about the future of marine heat waves as global warming continues?
That's a really good question. So in our study, we showed that the rising marine heat wave metrics were primarily driven by the rising mean ocean temperatures. So effectively, the global warming of the oceans is what is driving this increased frequency and duration of the marine heat waves. And while we didn't demonstrate in our study, we can rely on other published works that have effectively shown that global warming of the oceans is an anthropogenic signal. And so therefore, the rising trends that we see are predominantly driven by anthropogenic or human-caused climate change. And so the next step then is to exactly what you say. How is this going to continue into the future? How do we expect these trends to go throughout the rest of the 21st century, and that's actually what we're working on now. And to do that, we need to turn to models. We don't know what it's going to be like in 20, 30, 40 years, but we have fairly sophisticated and very good computer models for the climate system, for the oceans. And so we can use these models to simulate a projected future state of the ocean under different kinds of emission scenarios to tell us what we might expect the future state of the oceans to look like and the future state of marine heat waves. I will say that regardless of what those results show specifically, and that's work in progress, so I can't give you any numbers, it is the case that regardless of how we change our emissions, I'm talking about greenhouse gas emissions globally, the climate system has so much inertia in it now from the emissions that we've put in the system that it's not going to stop. It's not going to start cooling right away. So even if we were to stop emitting greenhouse gases right now, it's going to continue warming for at least the next few decades. And so we can expect these trends to continue regardless of what we do, at least for the near future.
Is there anybody responsible for watching out for marine heat waves? I mean, do we even have a real-time marine heat wave reporting system?
Not really, and that's something that needs to be, or it would be great if it was tackled. In the tropics, I would say that they've been looking at extreme ocean temperatures and thinking about these for much longer than, say, the mid-latitudes or the higher latitudes, and they are certainly aware of extreme temperatures in the tropics because of its impact on coral. So there are some programs like Coral Reef Watch that's run out of NOAA that does exactly what you're saying. They have real-time monitoring of ocean temperatures across the tropics, but it's not more broad than that. It doesn't function for the mid-latitude regions. So that's something that it will be really good to implement, both real-time but also hooking this definition of what a marine heat wave is into our forecast systems, because we have seasonal forecast systems that can give us some confidence about ocean temperatures 2, 3, 4, 6 months from now.
I didn't know that, and it would be interesting to see ocean forecasts. And one last question, and I don't want to be too dramatic here, but is there a possibility we'll get to the point of unexpected disasters for marine life due to a marine heat wave?
Well, I think we've actually already seen that in some regions. I mean, that kelp forest collapse being replaced by seagrass meadows on the west coast of Australia was absolutely unexpected. And I don't think it's been so disastrous for humans, but I think it was quite disastrous for some of the marine creatures living there. In 2012, there was one of these events that occurred here off the east coast of Canada and the U.S., and water temperatures in the spring were very high, anomalously high, and this caused the lobster fishery to unexpectedly have a massive increase in the number of landings earlier than usual. So the lobsters flooded the industry, flooded the system, and there was a unexpected drop in price, and there were a whole range of downstream effects on that, which led to economic and political tensions between Canada and the U.S. So I would say we're already seeing little hints of these kind of tensions and unexpected consequences arising.
We have been talking with Dr. Eric Oliver about the totally underreported phenomenon of marine heat waves. Eric and 14 other scientists from around the world have released an important new study in Nature Communications. The title is Longer and More Frequent Marine Heat Waves Over the Past Century. You can find links to the paper and this discussion in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Eric, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
The world's biggest structure built by living organisms is not Tokyo or New York. It is the Great Barrier Reef off Queensland, Australia, in the Coral Sea. It is over 1,400 miles long, 2,300 kilometers. It is a nursery for countless ocean species. And, as we learn in a horrifying new scientific report, the Great Barrier Reef is dying, killed by the hot seas of global warming. The title of the new paper published in the journal Nature is Global Warming Transforms Coral Reef Assemblages. We have reached co-author Dr. C. Mark Eakin. Mark is the coordinator of the Coral Reef Watch, run by NOAA, the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And as they say at that site, NOAA's Coral Reef Watch provides the only source of satellite-based monitoring, alerts, and warnings of upcoming coral mass bleaching events. From Maryland, Mark Eakin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks. Glad to be with you.
I've just spoken with Dr. Eric Oliver, whose team published a paper on global increases of marine heat waves. Tell us what happened to the sea temperatures off Queensland's coast of Australia in 2016.
Yes, and in fact, that's a very good paper to have come out, just before our paper, because that's what we were looking at, is one of these marine heat waves, actually two of them, that struck Australia's Great Barrier Reef. This was, in fact, part of a global coral mass bleaching event. This was the third global bleaching event to ever occur. The first was in 1998, the second in 2010, and this one surprisingly lasted for 3 years, from 2014 to 2017, including the two events on the Great Barrier Reef in 2016 and 2017. So in 2016, the Great Barrier Reef was hit by one of these marine heat waves, striking mostly the northern and far northern part of the Great Barrier Reef. That section, unfortunately for the corals, was one that had never seen heat stress like this before. So these sort of marine heat waves had not hit the northern Great Barrier Reef, and the corals were much more sensitive than most corals are because they hadn't been exposed to these kinds of conditions. And so the heat wave struck. We had mass coral bleaching and mortality. And in fact, the corals up there in the northern section were bleaching and dying at about half the level of heat stress that we usually see.
And how did this team and this project get going?
So the work being done in Australia is a part of ongoing efforts through James Cook University, the Australian Research Council Center of Excellence for Coral Reef Studies, the Australian Institute of Marine Science, the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority. And they have efforts going on to study coral reefs on the Great Barrier Reef on an ongoing basis. And in fact, Australian Institute of Marine Science has, in the past, when these large-scale bleaching events have hit in Australia, two of them being in 98 and 2002, they had used overflights, aircraft overflights, to see how much bleaching there was, as well as having divers who go out and look in the water to see what the after effects were, going out months later to see how much coral may have died. At the same time, NOAA's Coral Reef Watch that I run is an organization that's always monitoring for coral bleaching everywhere in the world, using a combination of satellite monitoring as well as climate models. And so since we have the data on the amount of heat stress that the corals exhibited, they had the data from the work, both the aerial surveys and now the in-water surveys, to understand how much coral had bleached and died. We worked together on this paper. It's actually the third of the papers that we've worked together on regarding these bleaching events.
Now, you say it was pretty well a three-year event of ocean heating, but I was pretty shocked at the figures that came out from just the 2016 period. I mean, your paper lists almost 4,000 different reefs. How much was lost in that period just in 2016?
In 2016 alone, the Great Barrier Reef lost just under 30% of its corals. So it's a huge number of corals. And, you know, most of that, because the majority of the heat and the most sensitive corals were both together in the northern part, the majority of the corals that died in 2016 were up in the northern part of the Great Barrier Reef.
Which happens to be a huge tourism area, so people expecting to see bright coral will still see some, I'm told by the Australians, but less and less as we go on. I wanted to talk about two different ways these changes show up that you talk about in the paper. The first is something called three-dimensionality. What does that mean?
Well, coral reefs are very important because they provide habitats for so many different animals, and they do that by forming structure. So, you know, grass is a plant, trees are plants, but grass and trees provide different kind of structure to animals that live in them, and coral reefs are the same way. Coral reefs provide that three-dimensional structures like trees do. So coral reefs actually serve very much the same way that forests do in providing a lot of structure. And so it's those corals, that provide, you know, the corals that grow up in branching forms and tabular forms and really provide that relief, that are the ones that provide the most and the most variety of habitat for other animals. And in fact, it's those fast-growing corals, the ones that provide most of that structure, are the ones that were hit the hardest.
Now, when they die, do they just topple over, or do they have to be hit by storms, or how do they lose that dimensionality?
Well, you're right. In one case, it is that they will be hit by storms, and they'll be weakened at that point. The other thing, and some other work that we've been doing with additional colleagues, has found that when these events happen, you actually very quickly start seeing bioerosion, or the breakdown of the reef by natural processes. Every coral reef is a balance between processes to build the reef and destroy the reef. I mean, if that weren't the case, the entire ocean bottom would be covered with coral reef. So coral reefs are constantly being broken down by fish like parrotfish, sea urchins and things that crawl around and scrape away the surface, worms and crabs and types of shellfish like mussels that will bore into the reef, and even sponges and types of algae and bacteria that will make pores inside of the coral. And all of these weaken the structure, break it down, turn reef material into sand, and that's how you get a lot of the sand on the beaches, especially along the Great Barrier Reef. The shoreline is covered with the sand that's been formed by corals. But all of these forces will start to take over and will very quickly start breaking things down. In fact, in Hawaii, as a part of a bleaching we had in 2014 in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, we saw a dramatic reduction in the amount of structure on that reef in under a year.
So a lot of those creatures that you've been talking about, I guess, are the second aspect discussed in the paper, which is labeled ecological functioning. Do you want to talk about that briefly?
That's right. So if you're going to have a very diverse coral reef ecosystem, first you have to have a variety of habitats formed by a diverse group of corals. If you have nothing but the same corals, and in fact the ones that survive best are these massive or boulder corals, they just look like big rocks. They don't provide a lot of hiding holes for animals on the reef. And so when you have all these branching structures and tabular structures and folio structures, you know, things that are shaped in all kinds of weird and wonderful shapes, you have all kinds of habitat for animals, whether it's fish, shrimp, crabs, worms, you name it. The Great Barrier Reef, just like any coral reef, is a very diverse habitat. And especially in the north, it's more diverse than the rest of the Great Barrier Reef. And so when these corals die, you immediately start losing some of those fish and other organisms that will no longer have their homes, they'll no longer have the sources of productivity. And so it not only causes a breakdown in the corals themselves, but a breakdown of the actual ecosystem as a whole.
And how much above normal heat did those waters go?
So the way we measure this heat stress is not in degrees, but in something called degree weeks. So if you imagine you have a hot day, that's stressful, but it's one day. Heat waves that cause problem on land and where people, you know, die from heat during heat waves, it's because those events are not only hot, but they continue for days and days and days. Well, these marine heat waves are lasting for weeks to even a few months. And during that time, the temperature is above normal. So if you have temperatures that are, say, 2 degrees Celsius above the normal warmest month temperature, then we will measure that as 2 degree weeks of stress. If the following week you have another week of 2 degrees, then you're now up to 4 degree weeks of stress. Normally, though, it doesn't go at levels quite that high. The temperatures usually during these events are in the range of 1 to 2 degrees Celsius above the normal maximum. And so when we add these up, you get values of heat stress that normally at 4 degree weeks of stress, you see significant bleaching. And at 8 degree weeks of stress, you see widespread bleaching and significant mortality. in this event, in the northern part of the Great Barrier Reef, they were seeing bleaching at 2 degree weeks of stress and starting to see mortality as, in some cases, as low as 3 degree weeks of stress. So they were really being affected at a lower level than we're used to.
But I would presume that's because they're closer to the tropics so that there is less normal variation, whereas as you get towards the poles, there is more variation, so maybe the creatures are more used to it.
Well, that's true, but it's not a matter of variation that we're talking about here. It's how much warmer it is than normal. So, you know, there are coral reefs in places that have a lot of variability. I mean, you know, places like Florida, you know, temperatures will swing much more up and down than they will in the southern Caribbean. Same thing on the Great Barrier Reef. When you get to the southern Great Barrier Reef, which, of course, is closer to the pole, they have more temperature variation normally than they do in the northern Great Barrier Reef, which is near the equator. But the concern isn't that total amount of variability, but how far they get above that upper limit that the corals are used to.
Were there particular conditions like an El Nino or La Nina or something else that led to this long-standing marine heat wave off the coast of Australia?
There was. In fact, that was a part of what was going on in this global bleaching event. We usually see the most bleaching going on during the second year of an El Nino. And in fact, I mentioned those previous global bleaching events. The 98 event and the 2010 event were both in years, in the second year of an El Nino. Well, in 2014, we started seeing a lot of heat stress, and we saw what looked like was going to be an El Nino. We were expecting a 2014-2015 El Nino. The ocean heated up in ways that looked like an El Nino, but the atmosphere never responded, and you need to have both in place to kick in and really form an El Nino. So as a result, there wasn't a 2014-2015 El Nino. We joke about it being the El No-Sho. But in 2015, then it started up again. We had the heat in the ocean, the atmosphere responded, and we had a 2015-2016 El Nino. And so what you're seeing at this point was that this El Nino was in place when the bleaching occurred in 2016. Now, interestingly enough, that stopped. We switched into La Nina conditions, and the 2017 marine heat wave the next year in Australia occurred during La Nina conditions. So one of the things that's important here is that we're no longer just seeing these things driven by El Nino or La Nina, but instead the warming that's gone on as a part of climate change has increased the temperatures of the ocean so that they're close to those thermal limits already. So it takes very little to push it over the top.
So, Mark, looking into your own private research, separate from this paper, I want to ask you, aside from the global warming caused by our greenhouse gases, does the presence of more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere affect coral directly?
It does, but in a secondary way. Corals build their skeletons of calcium carbonate, in other words, limestone. To do that, they have to have plenty of carbonate in the water. That is something that is harder for the corals to build their skeletons out of calcium carbonate when the water is more acidic. When you have more acid in the water, they don't build their skeletons as well. And the organisms that will naturally erode coral reefs are able to do that even faster. So when we have more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, more carbon dioxide goes into the water. That carbon dioxide dissociates and becomes carbonic acid, and it's a more acidic condition that's harder for corals to build their skeletons and easier for organisms like boring sponges and such to erode the reef. It's not something, though, that has a major effect on bleaching. There is some effect in some corals. It's been shown that some corals become more sensitive to high temperatures when the water is more acidic, but it's not true of all corals. In fact, we're not really sure just how widespread that is. Most corals do grow more slowly, but that really comes into play after an event like this, and you're looking to see how well the reef can recover.
In June 2016, as this disaster unfolded, I interviewed the world's greatest coral expert, Charlie Varon. He'd just flown back from looking at the reefs, his life work of exploring and cataloging the wonderful world of coral was being killed off. How are Australian scientists you've worked with taking this terrible news about the coral?
Oh, well, they've been living through it. It's been a bit of a nightmare in most cases, where reefs that they've been studying for years have been just completely destroyed. Now, you know, you have to keep in mind, though, that we're not saying the entire Great Barrier Reef is gone. It killed, say, you know, somewhere in the range of about a billion corals, but there's still about a billion corals left on the Great Barrier Reef. 2016, bleaching was mostly on. There was a bit of bleaching farther south, but not too far. The 2017 event then hit more in the central Great Barrier Reef. And the central Great Barrier Reef is more the area where tourists go, and there are a lot of activities. So, you know, between those, there was a lot of destruction. And in fact, in the 2 years combined, the Great Barrier Reef lost about half of all of its corals. So we're looking at an area where a lot of reefs are in bad shape. Some reefs are still surviving. Some corals are still surviving. And so most of the scientists are at the same time trying to document what happened and the problems of that bleaching event while trying to find ways to help the reef recover from these insults.
You know, when the ice, the Arctic sea ice, retreated in 2007 and it was jaw-dropping, it was unexpected, I was really shocked. I thought, all right, this is climate change. But I think this is another one of those events, but it hasn't really made the public consciousness outside of Australia of what is happening there.
Yeah, it's a big problem that people aren't realizing how much climate change is already going on and going on all around them. We never saw mass coral bleaching events before 1983, that really big El Nino that was occurring then. We never saw global bleaching events until 1998, and these have been increasing in frequency and intensity. Another paper that many members of the same team had in the journal Science about 2 months ago, we were able to analyze records from 100 sites around the world, coral reef sites, and we found that where in the 1980s we were seeing severe bleaching events once every 30 years, now we're seeing them once every 6 years. So this is a real acceleration. One thing that I would encourage your listeners to do if they haven't seen it yet and want to know more about this is watch the film Chasing Coral. You mentioned Charlie Varon. Charlie is in it. I'm in it briefly. I was one of the chief scientific advisors for it. And that film, Chasing Coral, really does a wonderful job of showing what's happening to the reefs, but does it while you follow the adventure of filmmakers and scientists and videographers who are trying to capture this bleaching event as it went on. So the 2016 bleaching on the Great Barrier Reef we're talking about right now is actually a major part of that film.
I will track that film down and put a link to it in my blog at ecoshock.org.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock, the world's largest green radio show on nonprofit stations. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Mark Eakin from NOAA's Coral Reef Watch. We're talking about the latest assessment of coral death in the Great Barrier Reef off Australia's coast. And I think that, you know, is it too much to say that the reef system is becoming dead, or is it damaged? Do we expect recovery?
So what we've seen is the collapse of many of those coral reefs. I mean, you know, you think about what happens if there's, say, a massive forest fire. Every tree isn't dead, but it's no longer functioning as a forest ecosystem. The trees aren't there. They don't provide the same habitats. The productivity isn't there. You have to see if you're going to have that recovery to come back as a forest, and that takes time. And it takes time for reefs to come back as well. Coral reefs that have suffered this sort of widespread coral death, you can start to see recovery in 10 to 15 years as you get a lot of the fastest growing corals coming back. But that's like having that forest fire and then coming back with shrubs. they're part of the process. They do provide cover, but they're not the whole thing. You've lost your big old trees, or in this case, your big old corals as well. And corals that take decades to centuries to grow in the first place take decades to centuries to recover as well. So yes, reefs can recover, but as I was saying, that recent paper we had in Science says that we're looking at the return of severe bleaching events once every 6 years, but yet even for that initial growth of coral cover, it takes 10 to 15. So we already are at a point where the recovery is taking longer than the return time of the events.
So now with this new paper in Nature, we do have a big red alarm flashing about a collapse in our environment. Is there anything to be done about this?
There is. There are very important things we need to be doing. And it's important that we all keep in mind that those of us who are working with this on a daily basis and realize how bad it is, we haven't given up hope. We certainly believe that we're going to have coral reefs in the future if we do our part and allow the reefs to do theirs. So what are some of those things? The first is we need to be dealing with climate change. The Paris Agreement calls for keeping temperature increase around the globe, the global average, to well below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial conditions. And it has a second target that it calls for efforts to keep long-term temperatures at 1.5 degrees or below. Well, actually, for coral reefs, 1.5 is what we need. Anything above 1.5 is going to be bad for reefs. Anything above 2 is going to be catastrophic. And so we need to be working on dealing with climate change by reducing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. You'll notice I didn't say reducing emissions, because it's not about just removing emissions. We also need to be thinking about negative emissions. How can we pull CO2 out of the atmosphere and clean up that part of our air that has been polluted, but we just can't see? The next thing, though, is we need to be reducing local stress. Problems like land-based sources of pollution, you know, runoff of fertilizer, nutrients, runoff of sediments from poor land use. You know, these are all problems that have been facing coral reefs and continue to. Overfishing or destructive practices of fishing, habitat destruction, you know, these are all really important things. And by reducing those stressors, it helps the reefs have a better chance of recovering. But now we need to be looking at some much more dramatic things. And in Australia, they're even looking at installing large fans that, big propellers that will draw cooler water up and pump it onto the reefs at time that the bleaching is going on. There also is talk about ships that will spray seawater into the air, producing low-level boundary, marine boundary layer clouds that can shade and cool the waters. So, you know, there are some actual direct actions we can take. The other one is the work that's going on coral restoration. The coral nurseries have been a great advance, especially for growing fast-growing corals, and there's some wonderful efforts underway. But one of the problems there is you never restore a habitat until you've removed the problem that killed things in the first place. And here with climate change, we're continuing to see that rising temperature. So there are teams that are working on selectively breeding corals that are better able to survive the future and using those as a part of these restoration activities. So there's a whole suite of things that are either underway or being contemplated that we need to be taking care of. But if we don't deal with that first one, if we don't address climate change, we shouldn't even bother with the rest.
And I would add one more thing. Let's not build a great big coal shipping port right near the reef as well, but we'll see whether that ever happens. How do our listeners find Coral Reef Watch, and how do they use it when they get there?
So Coral Reef Watch is easy to find online. It's coralreefwatch.noaa.gov. You can also find us at Coral Reef Watch on Twitter and Facebook. Most of our tools and materials are available on the website. You can go in there, and there are maps showing where the heat stress is potentially causing coral bleaching all around the world right now. There are detailed maps and tools with things like the gauges, like you see a fire danger when you go into a forest. We have bleaching danger gauges on the pages for different places. So whether you want to know about the Great Barrier Reef, whether you want to know about Florida, whether you want to know about Hawaii, you know, all of these are places that you can look at and see what the current heat stress levels are and what the climate models tell us are likely to be seeing in the about 4 months out. We can predict about 4 months ahead with pretty good accuracy. And so they can go through and do all of that. And if they live near a reef or have a reef they're particularly concerned about, they can sign up for email alerts, and they'll be alerted only when there's a change in the heat stress level on those reefs. And so we do this for all around the world. It's not just the U.S. So, you know, whether we're talking about, you know, Sri Lanka, Kiribati, or Florida, it's all the same.
One last thing. You just returned from Puerto Rico after yet another island-wide blackout, and that was the scene of a super hurricane, which we think climate change added to it. What is your sense of the feeling that people had there when the lights went out again?
Oh, again? They've become rather resigned to it. There was, in fact, just an outage that occurred last week that took out the power to 850 or 900,000 people in San Juan. This was bigger. It took out the power grid for the entire island. You're dealing with a Commonwealth of the U.S. that is not treated as though it's part of the U.S. It also is an area that is very poor and has very limited infrastructure by U.S. standards. So they don't have a very robust power grid, and so when power goes out, it's a lot tougher. So there's a lot that needs to be done there, and they know it. But they're also dealing with big, major economic problems that preceded the hurricane. So they're working through it, and they're trying to get help from people to deal with things, while at the same time they're still, you know, there are people without roofs and people who have not had power since Hurricane Maria came through last year, and we're just a little more than a month away from the beginning of the next hurricane season.
Well, to the people of Puerto Rico, we love you, and really we have the responsibility that these storms have become so extreme, in my opinion, because of our longstanding greenhouse gas emissions. But really, we've been talking about coral throughout this, and especially I want to encourage people to go and visit Coral Reef Watch. Our guest, Dr. Mark Eakin, is the coordinator of NOAA's Coral Reef Watch. He's the author of the paper published April 18th, 2018, co-author, I should say, in the journal Nature, titled Global Warming Transforms Coral Reef Assemblages. There's a lot to it. I encourage you to go and look at it. The lead author is Professor Terry P. Hughes, and he is from the ARC Center of Excellence Coral Reef Studies in Australia. Find links to the science and this discussion in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Mark, thank you so much for sharing your busy time with us.
Thanks for having me on. I'm glad to spend that time with you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. In the science world, there's a growing awareness of the dangers of extremes. If rains increase a little or decrease a little, nature adjusts. A little hotter and we all get by, even as the normal base continues to warm as each decade passes. But extreme precipitation events are blowing in across the globe, while elsewhere droughts last longer, forest fires burn earlier, later, and then all year round. As our guest Eric Oliver told us, there is no global monitoring system for marine heat waves. Just this week, a bottlenose dolphin was spotted in what should have been the cold waters off Vancouver Island on Canada's west coast. That should never happen. We need a marine warning system for the subtropics, where most of us live, as provided now for the tropics by NOAA's Coral Reef Watch. All of us on land should be told what is happening in the seas, along with our weather forecasts. We need to see the maps. The public hardly knows it, but marine heat waves may be the next big thing.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
My listeners educate me, as do my guests. Feel free to write me anytime. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. You can help the future. Please pass on this radio show through social media and wherever you travel on the Internet. And keep supporting your local nonprofit radio station. They keep this vital information beaming out. I'm Alex Smith. Join us again next week for more Radio EcoShock.